Hello everyone, we are live today. Today I have a fantastic guest, Gabriel Sion. Hello Gabriel, thanks for being my guest today.
Hello Ari, thanks so much for inviting me.
It's a great pleasure. So today we have a busy program because you're an amazing personality. So I'd like to take the time to develop your journey, because it's very important for our people to know you better. So first of all, just a short presentation, and then you can of course develop more further. You are IT engineer by training from one of the best engineering school in the world, Polytechnique, and also you made a specialization in Telecom Paris, which is another great engineering school in the world. And then very quickly, after a short period as an employee, you committed into entrepreneurship, which is very atypical for the polytechnician, I would say. And then you made a great exit. And then now you are committing into the longevity space. So I want to understand your deep motivation and what is your inner fire that drive your life. So are you okay with this program?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Excited to get started.
Great, great. So maybe we should start a little bit around your childhood and understand what was the young Gabriel in his family environment. And maybe you were already an engineer, you know, a tiny engineer who makes stuff in the background of his parents. Or did you discover your technical and scientific, fiber just before entering higher education? Because most of us, you know, we don't know what we want to do very late in our education system. What was your?
Yeah, so I was born in Romania, Bucharest.
Mm.
And my parents are teachers. My mother is a French teacher, and my father is a teacher in physics.
Mm.
And I grew in a very demanding family when it comes, and with very high expectations when it comes to academic achievements. For my parents, there was nothing more important than studies and academic results. So that was great and not so great for different aspects, like, for example, emotional balance and stuff like that. I was born and raised in a very competitive environment where I really had to go as far as possible when it comes to, you know, understanding mathematics and physics and stuff like that. So at that point, it was hard for me. And I had some sort of frustration seeing my neighbors and friends going outside and playing and not being able to do so. But, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So at some point, this helped me develop some skills and some resilience, which is one of my biggest strengths right now and one of my core foundations also. So I attended different competitions in mathematics and physics as a child, starting as soon as like 10 years old, I guess. And I continued with this. And, you know, I discovered that it was something that I really enjoyed. I enjoyed competition. I enjoyed mathematics. And I had a pretty sharp mind when it came to those kind of fields of knowledge. When I was in high school and then in high school, I also discovered that I liked to do, I didn't call it that way, but it was like business. What I did at that time, like 98% of the software was pirated in Romania. So it was not illegal. It was common, you know, ground. So I had a friend who had a CD writer. At that time, it was a very, very expensive device. And I partnered with him to copy games, video games, and then sell them to other friends. And this was the beginning of a very nice sort of business, you know. And this all it started like this, and then it ended up when we got a virus on those CDs that destroyed the motherboard. It was like the first viruses that could destroy not only the software but also the hardware. So it kind of destroyed our like local small business. So I was out of that business, and I started buying and selling secondhand smartphones. Smartphones were all rage at that time, back in the year 1995, 97, stuff like that.
How old were you?
I was like 16, 15, 15, okay. 16. And then after high school, I came, I got an excellent scholarship to come to France. And it was the end of those kind of small businesses. And it was very hard. It was very competitive. All the students were working like crazy. They were not only really smart, but also hard workers. So there was no more space for anything else than, you know, studies. So I stopped all that. And then in 2003, when I got my, when I got into Ecole Polytechnique, I said, you know, this is the first time in my life when I really have the possibility to create a business, like a legal one, and really create something around that. So this got me really excited. And I partnershiped with a friend who is in Ecole Centrale, which is another excellent, you know, engineering school in France. He was on the business side, I was on more on the technical side. So it was really exciting to raise funds when we were still students and work. We were working only part-time for this business, for this startup. So that was, you know, the beginning of my entrepreneurship journey.
And the choice, you know, to apply for Polytechnique and to follow this very demanding engineering school, because maybe you could have, I don't know, followed biology at university, or why specifically IT and Polytechnique, and how was your time at this school? Because it's a very it's kind of, you know, unknown for most people how the years you experience in this school.
Yeah. So why those kind of studies? Because I was pretty at ease with mathematics and physics, and also because Ecole Polytechnique is a sort of open door to virtually anything. Mm. So it's great to choose this school if you're selected and you get a place into it, of course, because it's highly competitive. Because this is going to be a very successful business card for the rest of your life. And also, I knew that I wanted to do something related to technology. I was fascinated by technology. So it looked like the right place to be when you want to do something in technology, you don't have a clear mind on what exactly. And you still want to have as many chances as possible to go in the direction that you would choose.
It's very interesting what you say, because I'm French, so I know this engineering school and what are their specialties and their specificities. And it's interesting to see what was your thought about this school as being a Romanian, you know, because you see Polytechnique as an engineering school that build technology startups and or contribute to the innovation. But we know that in Polytechnique produce a lot of big brain in mathematics that end up in financial institution, in higher administration or big corporation at sales level, but there are not so much entrepreneurs, you know, by blood, you know.
Absolutely. So listen, for me it was first of all, I have studied in a French high school. Mm-hmm. In Romania. So it was not the Romanian educational system, it was the French system. So we knew out there that Ecole Polytechnique and Ecole Centrale and some other Ivy League schools in France were the right place to be if you had results and you were a hard worker. So for me, it was a no-brainer to apply for those engineering schools. And then when I got to preparatory school, a class prépa, everyone wanted to, you know, get into Ecole Polytechnique or Ecole Centrale. So I was brought up in such a culture that it was absolutely a no-brainer that we should apply or at least aim at those kind of Ivy League schools.
And how about your study as Polytechnique? Was it too much fundamental, basic mathematics and physics, or do you have some experimental engineering and physics and so on?
Yeah. So first of all, maybe a couple of words related to the discipline in this school. Mm. So this school was created back in the 19th century, I guess, by Napoleon. And the purpose of this school was to train engineers for the big constructions in France, for the infrastructure, for roads, for trains, for huge buildings, stuff like that. So by definition, this school was a military school with a military discipline. And from the starting point, from its inception, oriented towards public servants, to train highly trained public servants. So back in 2003, when I got into it, the military discipline was very much still there. Now things have changed, but at that point, you know, we had people from the military hierarchy managing us, and it was like crazy. You had to follow rules. It wasn't very rational. It didn't make sense, but you still had to do this. You had a uniform, military uniform, which is good, you know, to hit on girls, but you still have to go on lots of ceremonies, and it didn't make too much sense to me. So this is why my managers, my supervisors hated me. and when military people hate you, it's a thing, you know.
Yeah.
So it taught me how to, you know, be calm and quiet and zen, you know, and not get crazy about their humiliations and stuff like that. Mm. So again, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Mm. Again, so it allowed me to learn a lot about myself and self discipline. And also self-confidence controlling yourself.
Mm. And what about the course in Polytechnique?
Yes,
was it too much
course.
Fundamental or basic, or did you have because I want to understand how Polytechnique produce thinker or makers, you know, or mix of both.
Yes, absolutely. So listen, this military mindset combined with academic excellence makes great people when it comes to execution. You know, future CEOs of big corporations, your mind is very clear. You know exactly what are the priorities. You know how to structure the whole thing. And you understand technology. And then you can also understand management from like an engineer. You know, you don't have that feeling, that intuition, but you can still understand different stuff. And then you can learn along the way during your professional experience. So I think it's great for big corporations, for consultancy firms like A.T. Kearney, McKinsey and stuff like that, because you learn how to acquire lots of information in very short amounts of time and how to structure this and put priorities on it. About the theory, yes, to be honest, there are only two or three specialties where the theory you're taught in Ecole Polytechnique is really useful. For example, in finance you're using highly advanced mathematical models, and everything you've learned in Ecole Polytechnique is really useful. But maybe research, because some of us become researchers, you know. And physics also. Some of us work, are going to work in ITER or other big research institutions. So that is great. And that everything you learn in Ecole Polytechnique is really going to be useful. But if you exclude those two big fields, you know, of competence, like theoretical physics and research in mathematics and research in general and finance, you forget almost everything. What you keep is your structure, the ability to acquire and manipulate lots of information, and the ability to work hard when it's needed.
And once again, you are kind of anomaly in this school, because you know the majority, as I said, the majority of polytechnicians end up in the higher finance institution or as a public servant, but at a top level. In the French administration or in the big corporation, but you became a startupper, you know. So it's very weird. Of course, now we have more and more polytechnicians who launch a startup, tech startup, by the way. But you are kind of anomaly, right?
At that time I was an outlier, to the point where my parents, who've never been entrepreneurs, who don't understand this world, this universe, and being in Romania outside of France and not understanding what was going on. At the end of my studies, I told them that I would not get hired by any company. I would start my own. And they were like, oh, poor Gabriel. Tell us, you can tell us honestly, you've sent your CVs to many companies and they didn't accept it, right? No, it's not. It's just I want to build my business. So it was a very unusual. And people didn't really understand what that was about. And also I remember some supervisors in Ecole Polytechnique who told me, you know, this is what you're doing is nonsense. You should work in a big corporation because you want to create your company, but you don't know to do anything. So what do you want to build? Work for a couple of years in a big corporation, learn some stuff, and then create your business based on what you've learned out there, which I know now that it didn't make any sense. But at that point, that was the mainstream mindset, you know, and everything that was outside of this kind of mindset was an anomaly, was a potential failure.
Mm-hmm. And how did the opportunity to launch the startup emerge, and why did you choose the subject or the idea? And did you pivot the idea? You know how?
So I remember that my supervisors, those military supervisors, I remember precisely. I went there and I asked them for a fax, you know, fax machine. Now it doesn't exist anymore, but at that time it was like the best way to communicate between businesses and companies. And they were like, who do you think you are to ask this? You're in a room with which is absolutely identical to all your neighbors' rooms, and you're not going to have a fax in it. So it was like I was like the most, it was outrageous for them to ask that. So I still got the fax machine. And I still have creating the company during my studies, but it like everything was against me when I started it. And by the way, I didn't even have the French nationality at that time, so I had to go to the police station, the prefecture, and to ask for a specific visa for company creators, which again was absolutely impossible to have. So it was those were hard times, to be honest. But again, once you go through all those challenges and you succeed, nothing else can kill you. Now when I have some hard times, I really remember how hard times were at that time, and it really fills me with self-confidence to go further.
My question is, you know, because I love to understand, you know, the very early moment of a creation of a startup, where the idea come from, where the co-founder meet each other, and did they have an eureka moment, or was it a long process before finding what they want to do?
So I knew again from high school that I wanted to create my company, no matter what. Mm. And then I've met this guy in class prépa, who then went to Ecole Polytechnique, and we remained friends. And he was a very astute business guy. His parents were entrepreneurs. He knew how to talk to people, how to raise funds. And he was very young, just like me, but he helped me a great deal in those aspects. So we were like, both really wanted to go outside the norm and create our company, even though this was not like the right way to go and the right timing for us officially. So it was exciting for us to be outside, you know, to think outside of the box and to act outside of the box, even though the social pressure was pretty high for us. And then I was at the end of the studies, I've worked a little bit as a consultant, but I also had the company at the same time. Mm. So I was able to compare both ecosystems and both activities. And it really did make sense for me to work as an employee, because you're just starting, you don't decide on anything, you don't generate revenue, you're just doing what other people are telling you what they don't want to do as a youngster. So for me, it was, again, a no-brainer to continue with the company, even though from the financial point of view, it was really hard, because on the one hand, you have a big salary from the starting point as a consultant, and on the other side, you have to like generate revenue by yourself, and it's much harder at least when you start. So it was in my DNA. It was this or nothing.
And did you have some external influence? Because I see that you launched Getimage 2016,
yes,
right? So it was the moment that we saw on YouTube, you know, popping up many entrepreneurs talking publicly, etc., talking about their venture and their journey, such as the family and Osama Amar, etc. Did you have some external influence also that contributed, you know, to your decision?
Yeah. So honestly, not really. So to be honest, there's something missing here in the timeline that I finished my study in 2008. Okay. I created the company in 2005. Mm. And my first company wasn't Getimail. That was my second one, more or less the third one. First, I started with a marketplace for software and graphic projects. Mm. Sort of now you have Malt in France. Mm. You have Upwork in United States. But at that time, there was a small company called Rent-A-Coder, which was then acquired by Upwork. And then they made a sort of big consortium. So it really made me think that it would be great to have such a marketplace on the French market or the French-speaking market with Morocco, Romania, France, Belgium, Switzerland, and Canada also, Quebec and other countries, French-speaking countries. And so that was my first business idea. I would say that I was inspired by Rent-A-Coder at that time. It wasn't an entrepreneur. The guy didn't have a crazy charisma, or maybe he did, but he wasn't on the social network. So I didn't really get to know him. His business was inspiring to me. Mm. Yeah. And his success also. So I tried to sort of choose a smaller market, the French market, and be the leader in it. So that was a source of inspiration for me. And then I would say that I was very much into execution mode. I didn't have time to listen to thought leaders, to YouTube influencers and people like that. And now retrospectively, I would say that it was a mistake on my side because I could have done things much easier with less effort, go much further. Had I listened a little bit more to other successful people and to their advice and the mistakes they've done, not to repeat them. But at that time, I was like, I need to get this mm-hmm. done. And every day was a struggle. And I really liked it. This, it really taught me a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, putting a lot of energy into something and succeeding gives you even more energy the day after. And that was the kind of dynamic that I was in at that time.
And what was the fate of this first startup? Did you sell it or did you end it?
Yeah.
Or?
So I would like to add something to your question previously. So yeah, and then I raised funds in 2008. Mm-hmm. So that initial business partner and co-founder left the company, and his shares were acquired by two entrepreneurs, a company managed by two entrepreneurs. And those guys, they had like 10, 15 years. They were 15 years older than me, mm-hmm. Laurent and Eric. And they really taught me a lot of stuff. For me, they were mentors. Yeah, I would say so. So great. I was strong on the technical side. But these guys taught me everything about management, about hiring people, about motivating them, about creating successful teams, how to raise funds. So they really helped me a great deal, to be honest. And when I raised funds from them, they hosted me in their open space. They had a big open space with their employees, who were also brilliant people. So it's really, yeah, I still see them as mentors today. Mm. Now, they also sold their company and they created other companies right now. So we see each other a little bit less, but I'm still very often thinking of them. I would say in a difficult situation, I think, what would they do in this situation, to be honest? Yeah. So a big thank to Laurent Dubernet and Derek Guignet.
Fantastic.
This helped me become what I am today.
This is a great anecdote. So they literally bought your the first startup, right? But you have still shares.
No, they have invested in it. They have invested in it back in 2008. Whoa, this is a long time ago. And then I was still, you know, I was still CEO of that company until 2014, 2015, when another fellow entrepreneur purchased the company.
Okay.
Yeah. So I sold that company, and which gave me, I mean, the company was already profitable. I learned a great deal. There was teams, there was a team that was already working from the operational point of view. So it was pretty easy for me to, you know, step out of the hierarchy and devote myself to my next startup.
And
so that was the story of,
Did you have employee at that time or not? Or you were?
Yeah. So that's interesting, man. That's interesting. So first I had like two employees, and then back in 2009 or 10, I went from 4 employees to 40 employees, like times 10 in 1 year. Wow. And from a small startup with a small number of people working around the same table, it became a huge like group of people working. So it was really exciting for me to learn how to onboard, how to hire these people, how to create systems around hiring, around training, around management, around motivation, to understand how people were thinking, what was the mindset of a sales guy, what was the mindset of an engineer, software engineer, completely different, how to talk to people, how people's minds are not always rational. That was very, very rich for me at that time. And again, Eric and Laurent really helped me a great deal with it.
And the company who bought your first startup, you know, we always read in business books that merger and acquisition are all in big operation, of course, always have this problem of culture. You know, when you want to mix two cultures, of course, from the bought company by the buyer company, there is always a problem of mixed culture, you know. And what about startup who are bought, and how was the fate of the employee? There was they integrated into the new one, and how they integrated into the new one?
Yeah. So to be honest, the person who bought the company was one of my my managers. Okay. So he had an entrepreneurial mind himself and really wanted to become independent. So it was easy for him to take over because he was already in the group. People respected him. They knew him. So it was a small step for a big step for him, but a small step for the rest of the team. It didn't really change much from the operational point of view. They still had their manager and the same cultures. The same values, and company culture.
Great. This is a very important point. So you sold the company and
then created the second one.
I wanted to say a French word, dans la foulée. How can it just after?
Yeah, immediately
or
did it after.
Take some time to think about.
It didn't happen immediately after. We have created the company immediately afterwards, but we had to pivot a couple of times before we found the product market. So what we knew with my new partner was that marketing and lead generation was a very hot topic on the internet on the one hand, and on the other hand, artificial intelligence. At that time we didn't call it artificial intelligence, it was more like machine learning and big data. And we wanted to combine both to create something outstanding. And we thought that we had this intuition that something big would come by combining those two universes. And this is how GetEmail.io was born. The market was huge. Everyone needed those kind of tools. We had the technology. My business partner, the CTO of GetEmail.io, was very knowledgeable about big data and machine learning. I knew everything about lead generation and direct marketing. So we've tried a couple of different products and had some customers, but didn't meet that much traction. And then when we created GetEmail.io, man, the product was a little bit shitty to start with, to be honest, but everyone was asking for it. I mean, they were really angry at us, but none of them cancel their subscription. So it really meant a lot to us that people are really asking for a reliable service, but since it's not that reliable for now, they still don't cancel their subscription. And to be honest, at that time, we had a strategy. I won't give names, company names, but we had a similar company who had an API, which was not the best one, to be honest, in terms of results, but it was still sort of working. So what we've done is create the website and use that API, which guessed professional email addresses, right? Mm-hmm. Getemail.io, as the name suggests, was about reliably guessing professional email addresses for companies who are prospects. So there were some APIs on the market at that time were average in terms of quality, but they still deliver some results. And we didn't want to create the technological brick until we validate the market. Mm. So we created a website and we used that API on the back end. Mm. And we bought credits, emails from that API provider, and we sold them twice as with a price twice as high. And after a couple of months, we kind of validated the market, the product market fit. So we were really confident to invest time, energy, and money into a better brick that would provide better results in terms of emails. So this is how getemail.io was born.
This is a great teaching, by the way, for entrepreneurs who are listening to us.
Sorry?
I said that it's a great teaching for the entrepreneurs who are listening to us.
Yeah, man, because the technology takes a lot of time, and it's a big risk. It's risky to create a technology when you're not sure that you will be able to sell it. Mm. And if you can avoid that, go ahead, do it. And validate your market, validate your pricing, start having lead generation systems, and bring the technology as a second step, if possible, again.
So with this trick, with using the competitor's API, you validate the desirability of the market. You know, people wanted to have the professional email of their leads. And then you were sure that, okay, this is where we have to put our efforts, right? And then you put all the effort on developing your own information system, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The technological brick was pretty heavy, to be honest. We crawled hundreds of millions of pages, maybe even billion of web pages. Wow. We had 500,000 euros in credits from Azure, mm-hmm. Microsoft Azure. And nobody was able to use all those credits. We were able to do so. So we really used them. You know, we had 100,000 euros of free credits from AWS. Also, we've used them like crazy. So it really helped us to have all those kind of perks that nobody was using to their full potential. We have used them to their full potential. Mm. And it really helped us. It's as if we had raised like 2 million euros. Because if we add all the different subsidies, all the different loans we got from the French government for innovation, all those perks from AWS, from OVH, which was also a local cloud provider. It really helped us a great deal.
This is great. So what was the fate of this company, the development, I mean, in terms of growth, employee, how much employee did you reach, your revenue, can you talk about a little bit about the fate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we were very much hands-on, my business partner and I. I had already created a successful company before. I knew lots of stuff and I had some experience and a vision on what to do and what not to do. And sometimes you have some easy way out. And I didn't want to take those directions. My business partner was more like thinking inside of the box and trying to follow the recommendation and the official successful way to go. When it comes to raising funds, for example, for him, for me, the best money is the money you get from your customers. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of unusual at that time, even now, I would say to a certain extent, because everyone wanted, I mean, the incubator where we were hosted, our mentors, everyone told us that we had to raise funds. And that was, success was like, looked like raising funds. And for me, success looked like being self-funding, self-funded. And increasing your revenue from the services and products you sell. So that was pretty counterintuitive. And also, it's honestly pretty easy to raise funds. It's an easy way out from the hard times of being an entrepreneur. And we had lots of temptations because business angels are here and there, and they want to put their money. But once you do that, you become sort of... dependent on them. You're not in control anymore to a certain extent, and I didn't want to go there. And my business partner, because he had a different financial situation also, to be honest, really wanted to raise funds. So finally I got to convince him that we shouldn't raise funds, and we haven't raised funds, and we were profitable soon enough to be able to pay salaries and start living from our own revenue generation. But at that time, there were some debates around this and some very stressful moments.
I can understand that.
I also remember, so, you know, that business was a SaaS business. SaaS business, the revenue system and the business model is very resilient in the SaaS revenue model. You know how many new customers you get, you know the churn rate. And everything is very predictable. So at that time, we had two employees who were software engineers. And my business partner, Nicola, really wanted to keep them because he invested so much time, so much energy into training them. But we didn't have enough money to pay ourselves. So it was that kind of difficult situation where it's either them, either us. So we had to let them go. And it was a very painful moment for my business partner. And at that time, I knew that the mathematical model of the SaaS business we had built showed us that in a couple of months, the revenue would go higher and we would have enough money, but not right now. So the risk was very, very high. So like 3 months after we let those people go, the revenue went really high and we were able to pay ourselves. But and we could have paid also those engineers, and maybe the company wouldn't have become what it has become if those people were there. But we had to let them go. And then we didn't hire new people in France, but we hired freelancers mainly in India. And that was a completely different direction from my previous company. And again, from the mainstream state of mind where you hire people and on site, and you take a bigger office. And then everyone, you know, you have a physical space and you bring everyone there. The culture was different if you do everything in remote and you hire teams, you know, worldwide. You have to be much more structured in the way you work, in the expectation, in the evaluation system. Everything took a different direction when we decided to not to hire people in a physical space, but we work with them entirely remotely.
It was a very smart move because at that time you didn't know yet, but the COVID coming, you know, the COVID monster was coming.
That was crazy stuff, man. it was absolutely incredible. Everyone around us was crazy about how they were going to continue their operation, their businesses. And for us, it was like business as usual. Really, nothing changed. Nothing changed. And on top of it, there were so many more opportunities in the digital world. And then there was this a government loan called PGE, Prêt Garanti par l'État, it's called. So like a guaranteed loan, government guaranteed loan or something like that, translated word by word. And we got like 1 million euros in loan, and we had only, we had zero employees. Everyone was out, even Nicola and myself were sort of CEOs, but we weren't employees from the like legal point of view. And we got 1 million to foster even more our growth, which at that time was already pretty steep. So for us, COVID was like the biggest opportunity of our lifetimes, to be honest.
It was great because you did such a great bold chess move, you know, by opting for you know the full remote organization, yeah. And it was you didn't expect the COVID, but you did it before the COVID, and it was a great convergence
a little bit of luck, a little bit of preparation. This is those are different ingredients in the magical recipe.
So you passed through the COVID crisis by continuing your growth, and it was great for you. And then how was the out of the COVID crisis?
So that's very interesting. You know, during that COVID crisis, the central banks, European Central Bank and Federal Reserve, printed a lot of money and basically gave the money to companies just to keep the economy working. So the markets went sky high at that time until 2021. So at the end of 2020, our company was already successful. We were paying ourselves, honestly, pretty comfortable amounts, my business partner and me. We already invested in real estate. Mm-hmm. And the company was profitable, and we had teams in place to be able to work a little bit less and delegate more. So we had this very tough discussion with my business partner, where I knew that the revenue of the company would go higher and higher because, again, there is a lot of predictability in SaaS models. Mm. So I knew that like 1 year and a half, at least the revenue would get higher and higher. And I said, okay, here we have a beautiful runway to sell the company. Because when you sell the company, you need to show quality execution and growth. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you spend a lot of time with potential acquirers. So unless you have a company that is like growing by itself, which is very difficult, selling a company in the best possible conditions is a real challenge. And we had that sort of one in a thousand situation where the company was growing by itself for 18 months. We were very profitable. There was no sense of urgency from the financial point of view. In the worst case scenario, anyway, the company, we would have generated a lot of money and we would have kept that profit. And there was also something else, which was that I was very motivated by growing even more. Mm-hmm. And my business partner was like, you know, we've done a marathon. Let's settle down. Let's have some nice time, family time, stuff like that. And I wasn't that much in that mood. So I thought that we were very successful to bring the company from, I would, zero to a couple of millions in revenue, and we would have to change completely our mindsets to bring the company from a couple of millions to a couple of dozens of millions. Mm. You know, everything changes. The culture, what is requested, the management, what makes the difference. You cannot just execute stuff. You need to delegate. And those are different competencies. And by the way, there are really few entrepreneurs who are able to be the best possible entrepreneurs for all the different stages in the growth of a company. You have Bill Gates, you have Elon Musk, you have Steve Jobs, people like that. But normal people like you and me, we are most of the time, we need to be honest about our competency and our skills. We are maybe great from 0 to 1 or 1 to 10 or 10 to 100 or 100 to 1 billion or a couple of billions. But we cannot be the best possible CEOs for each one of those stages. And for us as a team, I thought that we were great for 0 to 1. I mean, 2 or 3 or whatever. But you know, that was our excellence sweet spot. And this is where I decided that it would be the best moment to sell, because the company is growing, it's profitable, the markets are sky high. At that time, the valuation of similar SaaS businesses were like 10 times the yearly revenue. It was crazy, even 20 times. So I thought it was like the right moment to go ahead with selling the company. And I tried to find the best investment, possible investment bank. And there were some of them who were nice, but not outstanding. And I've met those brilliant guys from IPTP, Inflection Point Technology Partners. Great guys, really aliens. I didn't think there existed in the world people who are sleeping 2 hours per day and being so knowledgeable about how to talk, how to convince corporations to acquire companies, how to talk to the right people. It was incredible. I've learned in 6 months, I've learned more than I've learned in the previous 6 years. So at first, they didn't want to work with us because we were a small startup according to their standards. But there was this guy, Hubert Catanez, who was one of the partners out there. And I really liked this guy. He was very charismatic, a lot of energy. And I kind of it kind of resonated with me. So even if he told us that we are too small, he's not interested in it, I kept getting back to him and sort of gently harassing him. And at some point he said, you know, I like this guy, let's work with him. And this operation selling getemail.io ended up being one of their most successful operation until up to that time. We really enjoyed working together. It was very, very intensive, like crazy for us, but for them also. But the whole project between getting to know each other, signing the contract and selling the company took only 6 months, which is very, very short.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we sold the company on the 1st of October, 2021. I still remember. And it was the right window of opportunity because 3 months later, the markets were crashing and, you know, the valuation and the operation wouldn't have been possible hadn't we closed at that specific time at, you know, October, 2021. So we were also lucky. We executed well. We really worked as a team. But at the same time, we also had some luck. So we have to admit this, and it was not all depending on the quality of our work.
This is fascinating because once again, we hear the story of American IPO, American merger and acquisition of startups, you know, from Y Combinator. But we need to hear some European, French stories like that because it's very important that we have many great entrepreneurs. And what is interesting with the GetEmail is also the fact that you were 100% bootstrapped startup, you know, and now it's very à la mode in front of you. We have Lemlis, we have Eskimos who are show up, the CEO show up on YouTube, say, hey, we are bootstrapped and go bootstrap. It's very important. And here your very great testimony about being a bootstrap and how...
At that time, it wasn't trendy at all. And many companies were crashing when trying to be bootstrap because you need to execute very, very well if you want to get bootstrap. And you also need to leverage all the advantages that you get, even the smallest one. For example, you need to know how to in France at least, how to convince the government to give you subsidies. BPI France, you know, the French sovereign fund, which funds innovation. It's highly technical, to be honest, and there's rules that nobody explains to you on how this works. You need to find customers immediately. You cannot, you know, it's very, very counterintuitive, and at the end of the day, it's pretty hard to be technically and business-wise practical enough to generate revenue quickly enough to be bootstrapped and not crash in the middle of the road.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I don't know if you can talk about, because usually when there is a corporate acquisition, you know, the numbers are very confidential. If you want to talk about the how much you sell the company, you're free, or if you don't
I understand. So unfortunately, we had exactly that kind of clause in our contracts, and we're not allowed to discuss about that. But what I would say, just to give some insights, is that IPTP, this investment bank I told you about, they're really exceptional guys because most of the investment banks are working based on ratios. The ratio is like, well, you know, in your space, SaaS business is selling at X times their yearly revenue. And if we're working well, where this is going to be a little bit more than X. If the times are hard, it's going to be a little bit less than X. But, it, you know, the reference is X times. I mean, like 10 times, for example. Those guys from IPTP, they don't want to work with companies who generate lots of revenue, because they say, okay, but if they generate revenue, if they have financial statements, then we are going to value those companies based on ratios. And our contribution is going to be minimal. What we want to do is take products and companies that have strong IP or strong technological bricks, but they don't generate revenue, or they generate very little revenue. Because in that way, the company is not going to be evaluated based on ratios. It's going to be evaluated according to how charismatic we are and how well we are able to convince those corporations that those startups are worth like tens or hundreds of millions. And that's absolutely out of the box, you know, out of the box thinking. And this, they made a specialty out of this. So this is what they've done with our company also. They found out a big corporation who had like internal problems, and we were giving a solution. We were offering a solution to their internal problems, and their internal problems were huge. So the valuation of the company is not the ratio of our revenue, is how big of a problem we are solving. And when there is a big corporation such as DNB having 3 billion in revenue or so, you know, even the smallest problem is a big problem, in fact. So this is what they've used as, you know, a strategy and general mindset to evaluate the company at very high valuations.
Fantastic. Congratulations for this operation, because it's a life adventure, you know, from the idea to the sold to the sale. Yeah. It's a life adventure.
Yeah, full cycle.
Full cycle.
Yeah, it was, I was really, you know, proud of ourselves as a team, proud of my business partner, worked a lot also to really do full cycle. Yeah, it was exciting for me.
So now let's transition into the longevity space, because it's very uncommon, you know, for an IT engineer, an IT entrepreneur. Why the hell did you come into this biomedical world? What is your motivation to transition into this new world?
Yeah, so a couple of things related to the transition between my last startup and this this new whole new space. So after I sold the company, I had this kind of a very goal-oriented mindset all my life. I wanted to spend half of my life to earn as much money as possible to get my financial independence, and then the other half of my life doing something that makes sense to me, where money is going to be a second priority or no priority at all. I'm not talking specifically about charity, but at least I wouldn't do something where profit is the main motivation, right? So after I sold the company, I mean, I sold the company, I was 40, 41. So I really kept my timing, considering that Western life expectation is 8 years old. I sold my company at 40, which was roughly half of my time, half of my life. So I was really happy to, you know, abide by my standards and my timing. And then I thought, okay, so what would I do for the second part of my life? What really makes sense? So there were a couple of options on the table. The clean tech and environment was something that really resonated with me. Democracy and the state of democracy in the world, which is going backwards for a couple of years now, resonated with me also. And then that longevity stuff was something that I really didn't really think of it. I was thinking more about transhumanism, you know.
With the hardware and physical technology, I imagine,
yeah, absolutely. Right? How technology and humanity would emerge and become sorts of cyborgs. And I've even met a guy. So it wasn't longevity per se at that time. Longevity was one of the different aspects of transhumanism and human augmentation. And at that time, I remember I've met a guy. Who is a CEO of a company publicly traded on the Nasdaq market. And this guy told me about some experiments where you would connect the human nervous system to a sort of sixth sense provided by an infrared camera, for example, mm-hmm. or an ultrasound. And you could like plug a sixth sense to that the nervous system, and you would choose the one you want to have. Do you want to have night vision? Do you want to have ultrasound? What do you want to have? So it was like crazy, you know? And I was like, am I in a dream right now? And I mean, am I in a movie or am I in reality? And that guy had already been working on for a couple of years to this technology. And we were trying to see if I would be CEO of that company. Finally, we didn't go further. But that gave me a sort of a feeling of this is coming in the very next years. This is not something that is science fiction anymore. And then I longevity was one of the aspects of transhumanism. So this is when I got to know David Sinclair and Peter Diamandis and people like that who are really doing a great job in creating awareness on those aspects. They're a little bit overselling and create a little bit of hype, but you know, it's within reasonable boundaries, and I think it's a useful for the general image of the ecosystem and visibility. And then I started. I said, okay, so what's the most audacious purpose of all? Defeating aging seemed to me like it's, you know, the transcendence of humanity. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, I don't need money anymore. What really makes sense to me? I really like to be bold, to think outside of the box, and to set myself such ambitious goals that everyone considers them as impossible. And I really embraced, you know, this kind of value or aspiration I have. And I thought, well, okay, what's the most ambitious goal you might possibly imagine? And defeating aging seemed as the most crazy purpose. So this is where I decided that I would devote my life trying to reach this goal. And I've met a lot of brilliant and fascinating people around those kind of values and goals. There is a longevity community in the world talking about this, doing research about this, funding this. There's investment funds around this those kind of initiatives. Many people coming from the tech entrepreneurship space coming to the biotech entrepreneurship space to create longevity companies. And I was really kind of fascinated by this ecosystem and wanted to be part of it and to contribute to it to the best of my abilities. So I spent 2023 last year talking to as many entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, scientists, doctors as possible, trying to map the ecosystem and understand how it works, how it's structured, what are the rivalries inside it, what are the bottlenecks. Mm-hmm. And this is how I came up with the projects that I'm working on right now at a very operational level. Starting a couple of months ago, I started. So my goal was like this: to 2023 to understand the ecosystem and to find an action plan and to start executing that action plan starting 2024.
You have also because when we visit the website, I see also the name of Max Camerani, who is your co-founder, right?
Yeah, he's here with me.
So yeah, hello,
right
Mike.
Now. Yeah, he's. I mean.
Hello, Max.
Yeah, he's here.
So could you tell us a little bit about your co-founder and how did you meet and why is he also interested by this field?
Yeah, absolutely. So I met Max in one of these longevity conferences we've done some video conferencing online, but I really met him in real life in Zuzalu. Last year, it was a pop-up city, crazy idea, sponsored by Vitalik Buterin, founder of Ethereum, organized in Montenegro. Crazy, crazy people, crazy mindset. It was fascinating to have so many fascinating people, so such a high concentration of fascinating people per square kilometer. Never met that situation before. So this is where I've met Max in real life, and we quickly saw that we were aligned on the goal of defeating aging, on this awareness we both had that artificial intelligence is going to disrupt the whole world, but also biotechnology and longevity as a whole. And also about what we would call long-term projects, as opposed to the short-termism that we have right now in blockchain, in cryptocurrency, you know, fast businesses, fast revenue. It's something we are really standing at the opposite side of things and mindset. We really think that we need to think long term. We are really believing in compound interest when it comes to investment, of course, but also when it comes to projects like the ones we are dedicating ourselves to right now. And baby steps today are becoming bigger steps tomorrow and huge steps like in 10 or 20 years. Defeating aging is a big challenge, is a complex project, and you really need to think long term if you want to be successful. And you know, today the Western culture and society is, I mean, it's a democracy from the legal point of view. We could discuss about it, but I would say it's a short-term dictatorship, because Western governments are unable to take any decisions on the long term. Everything that goes above an election term is not of interest to them. And being able to have like visions on the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, which is the right mindset to have when you're looking at such big challenges, such as defeating aging, is something that is nowhere close if people like us don't do something to change the current paradigm and to make this happen. You know, there's this, so humanity, when we come together and we put the right resources in place, we can do incredible things. But we really need to think long term, and we really need to put the right resources in place. And this is very difficult today. If it's not short term and you don't have that, you know, return on investment of times three in 5 to 10 years. This is the current investment paradigm, and everything that sits outside of this paradigm is not fundable. And then there's this additional bottleneck when it comes to public research and development financing, that aging is not considered as a disease. So there is no private funding into this, because it's too long-term and too risky, and there's no public funding because aging is not a disease. So there's no funding at all. And we really think that we need to change this by thinking long-term, and also being bold in what we're thinking. We want to reach out to governments to explain to them that preventative medicine is the way to go. This is going to take 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. Nobody is here to imagine spending 10 to 15 years in public advocacy projects to convince governments to do that. We wanted to do something that nobody wants to do. That's you know, the kind of mindset we have with Max. And now there's a couple of us. It's not only us. When you set the goals and you openly communicate about them, there's other people joining.
Absolutely.
The team. And this is really exciting. And this is where things start growing, and the project becomes bigger than yourself.
So you perfectly answered the question that I had, that was why choose the foundation model and not becoming, I don't know, business angel or VC, or even buying an IP and building a biotech company. But you answered my question, because the foundation model is the perfect organization for what you have in mind, right?
Yeah, to be honest, there's more to it, because we may well want to do something for humanity and not to put money, you know, on the first level of priority. Cash is king still, you know, in the world. So I spent 40 years earning as much as possible, so I perfectly understand how important money is. I'm not a sort of idealist or dreamer. So money is important, and we need to have a lots of it to move the needle forward. So how do we do this? Foundations have this problem that they depend on generous donors, and when there is no more generous donors, or generous donors, or there's or the market is crashing and there's less money on the market, those billionaires or whatever will stop, you know, funding those kind of organizations. And this comes exactly in opposition, at odds with our idea to have long-term projects. We cannot have projects that we are going to stop after a year or two or three. So we want to have visibility. We want to have vision. We want to have predictability on those projects. So for this specific reason, we are creating a sort of mix between for-profit initiatives and this foundation, which is an NGO, I mean, a non-profit initiative. So the way it's going to work is that the foundation is going to be on top of the hierarchy, funding, supporting, and managing long-term projects or not directly profitable projects. I'm talking about public advocacy, about public operations, about research and development, you know, the kind of moonshots that nobody wants to fund, things like that. So this is going to be within the foundation. Now, everything that is profitable, that is fundable by public or private funds, is going to be hosted in a startup studio that is going to sit beneath the foundation and is going to have 100% of the shares of this startup studio are going to belong to the foundation. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be the cash cow, the cash machine for the foundation. And we are going to host, initiate, develop, and eventually sell profitable startups in the longevity space in the startup studio. And so companies are going to have two possible categories. One is cash flow companies, and the other are going to be startups that, you know, and the strategy is different. In one situation, you're sort of creating something that is going to generate dividends. So the value of those cash flow companies are not going to be very high, but this is still going to provide a steady flow of cash on a yearly basis. And the other one is startups that you create. Maybe they are not profitable, they are not generated revenue, but at the same time, maybe the technology that sits inside them is going to be evaluated at tens of millions or maybe billions of euros. So we are going to have both of them and create value within the startup studio. And this value creation is going to go up into the foundation, and this is where the revenues are going to come from.
And in terms of type of startups, so will you focus on deep tech and, research and development demanding type of startup, biotech, medtech, or more like close-to-market cash-making startup like wellness and supplement, longevity supplement startups such?
So this is still to be defined. We have three options. Either the wellness companies you're talking about, I would call them health span companies, because this is where the challenge of health span companies is to add a couple of 10 years of healthy life to a human average life, 10 or 20 years, you know. It doesn't change the paradigm of life on earth. You're still going to die. But at the same time, it helps you live longer and better, which is already great. And then you have the lifespan companies, which is more about hardcore biotech, where you're trying to tackle the hallmarks of aging. You know, there's 14 of them right now. A couple of years, there were 9, 6, and then 9, and then 14, and maybe many more. But the idea is to tackle each one of them, trying to understand them and to slow the process of aging or even reversing it. So it's very bold. It's research and development. It is highly risky also. So for now, we are trying to understand, and I'm working with a brilliant guy called Matthew Burris, who has been creating startup studios for the last 10 years or 15 years. So he really has a deep expertise into this. And we are trying to understand if there's an opportunity to create a startup studio that would host both categories of companies or only one of them and eventually creating another startup studio with another, you know, positioning for hardcore biotech.
Mm-hmm.
So this is still work in progress. It's very early on. I have, again, started working on this startup studio project in January, like 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very early and we are moving quickly, but we are still far away.
So this startup studio and producing startup, if I can use the term, is one of the acts of the foundation. You have also other axes. We talked about this before. Could Absolutely. You talk about maybe you would like also to build a business angel club, right?
So just one thing before I directly answer your question. The first startup that is going to be hosted by this startup studio, we already created it. It's called Icar.ai.
Hmm.
And it's an online longevity consultation platform where we bring longevity doctors and life coaches to the service of patients who are in good health and want to stay that way. So this company is already created. We already have a revenue. We already have patients. We already have doctors and coaches. So it's really exciting for me to bring the whole expertise in execution I gathered through so many years, the last 20 years as an entrepreneur, and putting it to the service of longevity and being able to execute really quickly and well and generate revenue and create successful companies. And this is like our first initiative. And with Max and Guillaume and Denis, my partners, we are very happy to, you know, turn this into reality so quickly.
So, and in terms of ideation, is it something that because the startups here have different models, there are those who make call to entrepreneurs to come with their idea, or do you nurture the idea inside and you have a kind of closed door, you know, and you work?
Absolutely. Again, listen, we're working on this right now. I personally think that you have to take ideas wherever they come from. Mm-hmm. And we should have some flexibility when it comes to where the ideation comes from and how we onboard eventual founders that have the idea but didn't quite move forward with the practical terms of company creation and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So this is still, again, work in progress. It so happens that startup studios are a very special kind of animal. They're very complex. There's many stakeholders. And you need to find the right way to share the pizza, to give the right pie to the right groups of persons. You have the general partners. You have the limited partners. You have entrepreneurs. And each mm-hmm. one of them needs to capture a portion of the value creation. And then you have the foundation, of course. Mm-hmm. And each one of them needs to capture the right portion of the value creation. If it's too high, then the foundation will not benefit from it. So this is the purpose for what we're doing. But if it's too little, they will not feel motivated and things will not be optimal neither. So there is a lot of work around those kind of Absolutely. Issues before we find the right formula.
Mm, absolutely. And what about the other axes you would like to develop with the foundation?
Absolutely. So again, I'm a very, very practical guy and I really like to aim very high. But also, I want to keep my feet on the ground and to move forward with baby steps if necessary, but in very practical terms. I'm not a dreamer. So I've been thinking a lot with Max and other folks, exactly what is available to us right now, how we can move things right now in the right direction. So we came up with a bunch of ideas that we are executing on right now. And one of those ideas is, to create a longevity investment club
mm-hmm.
and to bring as many investors as possible and also and allow them to invest in longevity startups, be they biotech or health span or preventative medicine, or again, what you said was wellness or supplements.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what you are interested is that it needs to be a longevity startup with a clear path to profit. And when it comes to biotech, there are some biotechs where there are clear paths to, or they're pretty far in the process, you know, and they already have drugs or very promising results in clinical trials. So there are still some opportunities in biotech that offer reasonable return on investment expectations. Mm-hmm. So we would allow those startups to pitch their projects and to raise funds from investors. And for investors, I mean, I think investors are obviously pretty wealthy people, right? If you invest, you need to have money to invest. So they are also the people who are moving society further. So it's a great opportunity for them to invest, but it's also a great opportunity for us to educate the elite to this longevity space. Mm. And let them know that it exists, that there is a high opportunity. They can do stuff on their by themselves to lengthen their lives and to live better and longer. So for me, it's a great, this longevity investment club is a great way to get things started. I have already tested the value proposition. Investors are really interested to know more about longevity. Many of them haven't heard of it or have heard of it, but want to know more. So it's a mix of curiosity and also investment opportunity. Longevity might be one of the biggest investment opportunities in the history of investment, you know. So it's interesting for them to at least be curious and find out as much as possible, and then they take their decision. But if you cannot, as an investor, you cannot do your job seriously if you don't expose yourself to longevity and you don't look at this and spend some time trying to understand how this works. So we are offering them this kind of opportunity. And as it happens, it resonates pretty well with them. We have very good conversion rates. And since I come from this lead generation space and marketing automation, I know how to scale this up. So after testing it manually, this is going to go really big, you know, worldwide.
And as yourself and Max are both ITIs, I'm pretty sure that you have already in mind the type of platform you want to develop for them. And
absolutely. Absolutely. This is ongoing and we are excited. And we don't need many resources. We don't need to raise funds. This is something that we can get going right off the bat right now.
Perfect. There are also other axes you would like to develop, right? Maybe the community and how can I say conference for to connect scientists with the investor, with the politician, and etc.
So there is going to be public advocacy. Mm. I'm not giving names, but we have in our team right now, we have someone who has been working in public advocacy for the last 15 years, and who is very knowledgeable about how we convince the government. I mean, it takes a lot of time, of course, and there is a lot of uncertainty when it comes to this kind of operations. But if you're thinking long term and you're sort of resilient and persistent in what you want to achieve, at the end of the day, even if it takes a long time, you're still going to get to your goals. Of course, you need also financial resources to fund those operations, to create studies that show, for example, how important it is for governments to invest in longevity, mm-hmm. in preventative medicine. So this is going to require a certain amount of money and a lot of time and work. But if you want to move things forward, this is the right way to go. Patience, resilience, persistence, and strategy, and execution.
Absolutely, because we didn't say it clearly in our talk, but I wrote it in the article. Disease. We know now that aging is the mother of all organic intrinsic diseases that affect us after 45, 50 years old, you know, Alzheimer, Parkinson, and metabolic syndrome, and cancers, et cetera, and we know that we have to consider to change the paradigm of this specialty medicine based on specialties, you know, diabetology, hepatology.
Yeah, absolutely. Cetera, it's blah, blah, blah. We need to change the view, the mindset. Longevity is about taking care of all those systems and considering them as a whole, not separating them from each other. that's a very interesting part, you know, because engineers, what we know to do, and what I have been trained to do, is when you have a complex problem, cut the problem into smaller problems, fix each simple problem independently, and then you reassemble the pieces of the puzzle together. This doesn't work for life sciences.
Absolutely.
Because the evolution has created such complex systems with so many interactions between each subsystem that you cannot just set them apart and analyze them independently. Mm-hmm. There are too many interactions between them. And the human brain, even the brightest minds in the world, they cannot understand this complexity because you cannot divide it. You cannot split it into smaller parts. Or at least there are limits, as you say, you know. And artificial intelligence will be able to understand those complex systems and find holistic solutions to it. I'm really completely bullish on artificial intelligence and how this is going to completely disrupt life sciences and longevity in particular.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. What we see with generative artificial intelligence, you know, is only the visible side of the iceberg, you know. It's okay, it's very impressive and make a lot of buzz in the media, but in the invisible part of the iceberg, artificial intelligence can be very helpful for deep research, you know. For
absolutely, and I have a couple of friends from Ecole Polytechnique really actually working on AI models for drug discovery, for mice experiments, for everything that needs, you know, to tackle this complexity of living organisms.
We are living a very new era in terms of research and discovery. It's fascinating.
This is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. This, for me, is the best possible time that epoch that I could live in. When you think that Neuralink is implanting chips in people's brains and they got the FDA approval for now, for sick people, very sick people. Mm-hmm. But like in 5 years or 10 years, when those devices are going to prove that they are reliable and they don't damage the brain, I'm almost sure. I mean, Elon Musk already said that he would be like one of the first ones who would implant such a chip in his brain for human augmentation, not for diseases. I mean, once the device is secure, I would be excited to have like ChatGPT and internet in my brain, you know, to have a direct communication. It's exciting. So if you can imagine this, you can imagine that with AI, technology would go much further. We would discover many things in a short amount of time. Maybe in a couple of decades we would go on Mars, and we won't even have problems with overpopulation of Earth because we are going to, you know, conquer space. In 10 or 20 years, it's highly likely that we would have nuclear fusion, so an endless source of energy. So when you look at this era of abundance that is coming upon us, this is absolutely the best possible time to live.
Absolutely. And if you want to be part of this, join Foundation 2060, because it's the place to be for making the future happen.
Yeah, we are doing our best. I mean, there are many initiatives worldwide, and we are trying to partnership with them and to support them. I think the more similar initiatives we have, the better. There's no place for competition. We are all of us, we're not fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. We are fighting against aging, and we want to defeat it. And that's the common enemy.
You know the quotes attributed to Yuval Hariri, you know, when we have one archaic human who tried to kill a mammoth, he can't succeed. You know, the mammoth will kill it. Will kill the human. Yes. Then the human come back with five people. If it doesn't, if it are not sufficient, they come back tomorrow with 10,000. Then they win. You know, this is how human being works. Collaboration, collective intelligence, and this is what makes us specific species, you know, among other living entities on Earth.
Absolutely. And imagine, those two books from Yuval Harari, Homo Sapiens and then Homo Deus, they were like some of the best books I've ever read. Really. The way this guy combined anthropology, history, science, and combined them into a unique view perspective on human history, it was absolutely mind-blowing to me. And I really think that we are going in that direction. I think this guy has a very, very bold, but at the same time, very realistic vision on what's coming in the very next years.
Absolutely, we are totally agree. As we are reaching the end of this fascinating interview, would you like to add some words about Foundation 2060 and what is the next step for this new venture?
Yeah. So we're already 100 members, so mm-hmm. we are meeting huge traction. The people are really exciting. There's scientists, there's entrepreneurs, there's lobbyists, or this is not the right politically correct word to use, but anyway, you get it. And we're working with them on a specific set of projects. You know, like the longevity. Like the longevity investment club, like ecard.ai for consultations, like the startup studio, the events that we are starting to organize. Mm-hmm. So if defeating aging by 2060 really resonates with you, I highly suggest that you reach out to us, you sign up, and we increase the team of members who are working towards this goal after and get closer and closer to this tipping point beyond which investing in longevity is going to be a no-brainer and everyone is going to do this. Like AI today. I mean, AI 10 years ago, it was a risky investment and nobody would go there. Now, everyone wants to go there. And I would really want to contribute as much as possible to bringing the longevity space to that tipping point beyond which you have to do nothing else. It needs to be done. The whole humanity is going to be heads on into it.
Absolutely. Fantastic. It's a very important mission. And I think there are a lot of people who are excited by what you say and what would like to join you. So maybe to end this great interview, we can chill it a little bit with maybe can you offer some advice to first-time entrepreneurs, first-time tech entrepreneur, engineer, or scientist?
Yeah.
Are your inspiration? What do you read? What do you want to recommend as a source of information?
Yeah. And another question that is similar to this one, different way of asking the question, is what would my 40-year-old tell to my 20-year-old entrepreneur? Mm-hmm. Because that was on my mind at that time. Honestly, I would say one thing is to take a life coach and to really think of personal development. That is very, very important. Not all of us are meant to be entrepreneurs. Even the ones who are really motivated by this goal, we have many limiting beliefs. I had lots of limiting beliefs, and it took me a long time until I had this mindset to take a life coach and to analyze those limiting beliefs. And when I've done that, I mean, my projects and my success went like this. You know, there was a real inflection point. If I had this kind of mindset and the maturity to take a life coach, the right life coach, because you have all sorts of people, you have to choose the right one for you. But do this because you have so many limiting beliefs. It's incredible. And you can become like 10 times the person you are right now if you understand who you are, what are your strengths, and what are your sweet spots?
This is very important what you say, because first of all, most people have a weird idea what is a life coach or an executive coach is or is not. You know, how do you choose, or what are the parameters you need to? How do you recommend to choose the right one?
Yeah, so let me tell you what I'm doing myself. So I'm asking friends about their life coaches. I mean, I've been doing this because now I have someone who is really outstanding, and she's been helping me for 5 years now, and it's really, really extraordinary. And by the way, she's coaching now Max and my other business partners, and I'm sort of using her everywhere when it comes to teamwork and trying to discover and exploit the full potential of each one of us. So what I would do is ask your friends about it, and some of them hopefully will have some life coaches, and then you can, this is a good starting point, and then start working with them. So what happened to me was that in some situations, some of them just didn't fit. So I, after a first working session, I would stop working with them. Some of them helped me for 10 or 15 or 20 working sessions, like a couple of months. And at that, at some point, you reach a limit, an upper limit, and it's like they taught you what they had to teach you, and, and there's like nothing else, and you, it's kind of becomes useless. And then at, when I reached that kind of threshold, I changed the life coach, and now the lady I found out again, she's so great. I don't know if I will reach a certain upper limit with her. Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. But anyway, in the last 5 years, she's completely changed my life, and I'm so happy to continue working with her. I'm far from reaching any limits with her.
Fantastic. Fantastic to share this, because it's very important. I know also a lot of executive coach, and they are fantastic, and they do a fantastic job. Maybe your last point, what do you recommend as a book, as a movie, as a theory, as a blog post, to influence us, or it could be in the entrepreneurship, in the tech, in the science, or anything you want.
Okay, so we've already discussed about the Yuval Harari, Homo sapiens and Homo Deus. That's incredibly valuable. There is another a very interesting book. It's a French book called L'Apocalypse Cognitive, written by Gerald Bronner. So it speaks about how humanity has reached a point like a couple of decades ago where we can work less and less and still cater to our basic needs. And instead of, we've never had so much available brain power to do whatever we want. And instead of using it to write books, to transcend ourselves, we are just spending time on Netflix and on social networks, which is completely stupid. But it's a choice at the end of the day, you know, and each one of us is responsible for this. So there's a lot of analysis and very thoughtful ideas in this book. So I really recommend this also. And then there's another one. Man, a great book. It's The Black Swan from Nicola Taleb Nassim. That also changed my life. Because I had this deep in my brain wanting to go outside of the norms, but I consider myself as an outlier, as an anomaly. And when I've read this book, this guy really created a theory about it and really explained why it was just a way of being and how great things you could do with such a state of mind if you consider that it's not a disadvantage or flaw, but a strength. And I'm really living by that kind of, those kind of values, and understanding how I could leverage being outside of the norm and looking at a phenomenon as a law of power and not, you know, that Gaussian statistic curve. So it's very deep. Now, people who haven't read this will not understand, but please read this. It's mind-blowing.
I will for sure share all the link of the books, the titles, so they will have it in the replay and in the article blog that will accompany this great interview.
Yeah, and the last one.
Please.
Yes, The Tao of Capital, it's called. The Tao of Capital. It's a book. It's completely, when you read the book, it's a long, very long book. And it, they say it's a book about finance. And you start reading that book and you learn things about wars, about history, about biology. And it seems like a mistake. You know, the whole book looks like a mistake until you reach the last chapter. And you really understand that all the beginning of the book was preparatory work for what's coming afterward. Really, really well written. It's very entertaining and very deep also about investment. But you can also apply this to general your general life.
The Tao, right? The Tao of Capital.
The Tao of Capital. Absolutely.
Perfect. I will find it. I will put it in the resource of the interview. Gabriel, thank you so much. It was such a great honor and pleasure to have you for this interview. What you are doing is very important and it's precious for the humankind. So Thank you so much again for being my guest.
Thanks for inviting me. It was great talking about this. This is one of my very first podcasts. I've always been more in execution mode, mm-hmm. and not very comfortable with those kind of activities and exercises. Thank you very much for inviting me. I hope it was worthwhile.
It was perfect. Thanks for sharing all of these tips and your life experience in the entrepreneurship, because it's very precious. Thanks again.